This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zympht. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Yeehaw.
Hi, Benji. Thanks so much for sending me the inscribed copy of your new book. I finished reading it, and I enjoyed it so much that I sent four more from Amazon to some of my dear ones. Last time, on Sequitur All Souls, we had a sample of the contents of Limericks of Doom 2. The Blind Men Were Irrelevant, your parody of the classic The Blind Men and the Elephant. It was a hoot to see those verses in print. Today I've got Guy McPherson as my featured guest, and I'm launching a two-show series on end-of-life decision-making with an emphasis on conscious death, and I invite you to editorialize with additional material from Limericks of Doom 2, okay?
Yeehaw!
It's appalling how little choice we have about that, isn't it?
You know, starvation, suicide, or predation are the choices on careful mentation. And if you still think we're not going extinct, you don't understand the situation. When NTE hits planets wide, we can run, but with nowhere to hide, it will turn out that we must choose one of three: predation, starvation, or suicide. Hee-haw!
Well, I don't disagree, but I do think you're oversimplifying the situation. Let's see what Guy has to say about it. By way of a very abbreviated introduction, I will remind my listeners that Guy McPherson is Professor Emeritus of Conservation Biology from the University of Arizona, who has taken an early retirement or long-term sabbatical in the heart of the jungle of Serpent Island, aka Central America, in Belize, where he is living in a local off-grid community. Meanwhile, he is continuing his valuable service to our global community of keeping us informed of developments in the peer-reviewed scientific literature through his Nature Bats Last website, guymcpherson.com, and through his lecture tours, YouTube videos, and participation in podcasts such as Sequitur. I followed his recent Canadian lecture tour with great interest and have condensed his presentation for this show, and I managed to catch up with him for a real-time conversation on his way home, on his layover at his New Mexico property, while he still had what he called first-world internet access. I am so thrilled to be able to actually connect with you today. You opened your presentation with that whole thing about terminal diagnosis, and that's what named this show. Let's have a listen.
The question to which I'm going to respond today is, how does one live with a terminal diagnosis? We've all been given one at birth. You all know that you're going to die. We all know that birth is lethal. Yet we walk around acting as if everybody else is going to die, but it's going to have no influence on me. My response to this information is action. I have never proposed inaction in response to our terminal diagnosis. And in fact, most people that I know about, that I've read about, that I've heard about, when they're in hospice, do not say, I should have bought more crap. Instead, when given a terminal diagnosis, they identify the important things to do in their lives. Completing relationships, seeing those people they've always wanted to see, going to those places maybe that they've wanted to go to, including deep inside their own heart. So, as Edward Abbey said, action is the antidote to despair. If you despair after receiving this information, you probably understood it correctly, and I encourage you to act.
You know, politics used as distraction from extinction's fatal attraction often helps introduce a convenient excuse for useless, irrelevant action. Hee-haw!
In fact, activists have great difficulty accepting this message. People who are lifelong activists have thrown their lives into making substantive change in the world. And so they think what I'm going to tell them is that it's all been for naught. And that's absolutely not the case. We might not be able to influence the future. We certainly can't influence the past, but we can live in the here and the now, and we can try to make the world a better place. I've been trying for many years, and every year the world becomes a worse place. You have to do what you think is right. You have to do it well, and you can't be attached to the outcome. It's not as if we weren't warned. The United Nations director of the New York office of the United Nations Environment Program in 1989 said governments have a 10-year window of opportunity to solve the greenhouse effect before it spins out of human control. That appeared in every major newspaper in the United States because it was released by the Associated Press. 1989 plus 10 years makes 1999, which was 18 years ago. And we didn't solve anything. The situation only became worse in that 10 years, and in the next 10 years, and in the next 8 years after that. We were warned again, not by an individual in the United Nations, but by a body put together by the United Nations, the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases, in October 1990, just about 16 months after Noel Brown's infamous statement, pointed out that beyond 1 degree C, and this is 1 degree C above the 1750 baseline that marks the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, beyond 1 degree C may elicit rapid, predictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. Just two important points here. One, rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses. That's another phrase indicating self-reinforcing feedback loops. Positive feedbacks that feed upon themselves. So the faster they go, the bigger they get, the bigger they get, the faster they go. And the second point here, extensive ecosystem damage. The United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases knew what was important. What's important for animals, including human animals, is habitat. Extensive ecosystem damage means you can't have the dust bowl that never ends and grow enough food to feed a nation or a world.
I want to interrupt you for a moment for a few words about this slippery notion of a pre-industrial baseline. Could you speak to that?
1750 is when we started at scale using the steam engine and started throwing on the coal and so on. Lately, I hear more often 1850. Somewhere along the way, the decision was made at a large scale to not report 1750 as being the Industrial Revolution. It was 1850. That's the new strategy. Switch the baseline. So now the baseline is typically presented as 1980 to 2010. So we skip the first 200 years of the Industrial Revolution so that it doesn't look like things are so bad. So now the temperature's only gone up a half a degree over the baseline, which just started the day before yesterday. The preferred target was 1.5°C above the baseline at 1850. But really, if they're serious, it's 1.5 above 1750, and we're already higher than that, and we were at the time. So we're currently somewhere between 1.6 and 1.8 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline, depending upon which large governmental body is presenting the evidence. But it's at least 1.6 degrees above the 1750 baseline. And if collapsing civilization as a result of the loss of global dimming causes the temperature to go up, and not collapsing civilization because civilization is a heat engine causes the temperature to go up, then where do you think it's going to go? I think it's going to go up. And so 2 is in the rearview mirror decades ago as a result of global dimming. Even taking the most conservative analysis possible and using the paper from 2011, Hansen and colleagues, 1.2 plus or minus 0.2, well, we're at 1.6 now. Global dimming takes us to minimum 2.8. Whoops. That's well above 2. That's well above the temperature at which humans have persisted on the planet in the past. You have to be very careful. There's a lot of shifting of the baseline and maneuvering going on. There's nothing new about this. This is what governments do. And it's what they've always done.
Hee-haw!
What Benji said. As you were saying about the warnings we got from the scientific community?
The warnings continued. David Spratt indicated in retrospect that probably 1 degree was too high. Half a degree was the point at which we triggered a bunch of self-reinforcing feedback loops. You only know that you've triggered them when they're in the rearview mirror. I've documented 5 or 6 dozen of them at my blog, and I stopped counting a little over a year ago. I've already alluded to the idea that when we get rid of all the grass, we are the livestock. When we get rid of all the food because of these self-reinforcing feedback loops that speed up the process of climate change, we get to the point at which we can't grow food. In other words, we don't have habitat for human animals. Habitat, straight from my buddies Merriam and Webster, is the place or environment where a plant or animal, and they don't say including human animals, but I'm pretty sure they meant that, normally lives and grows. We have humans in the International Space Station. The International Space Station is not habitat for human animals. Humans do not normally live and grow on the International Space Station. We can take food there. We can filter the water. We can provide for certain necessary items for human survival. But they come from Earth. Humans can live in nuclear submarines for a long time, a year or so, but that's not habitat. The nuclear submarine does not provide the necessary ingredients for human life. Rather, all that food has to be stored on board. So the habitat, or the place or environment where a plant or animal normally lives and grows for humans, is Earth. So I'm going to restrict my focus here to the third rock from the sun. All of these large-scale assessments assume business as usual. They assume no self-reinforcing feedback loops that we were warned about in 1990 by the Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases from the United Nations, and they assume no global dimming. Perhaps the best known scientific body on the planet when it comes to climate change, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, with their fourth assessment late 2007, concluded we're headed for, by 2100, 2 to 4.5 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline, when the global average temperature of the planet was about 13.5 degrees C. Just about a year later, 2C, forecast by the Hadley Center for Meteorological Research, the large governmental body in the UK that studies climate change. United Nations Environment Program, 3.5 C by 2100. Notice we're all at 2100 so far. So far in the future, we're talking about our grandchildren. So we don't really need to do a thing, because it's in 2100. That's when things get real. Hadley Center says 4 C by 2060. Ooh, that's getting a little uncomfortable. For comparison, Ice Age is 12 degrees Celsius. Civilization started popping up all over the planet at 13.5 degrees Celsius. 1.5 degree difference made the difference between an ice age and the ability to grow grains at large scale. So an additional 4 degrees C is a big, big deal. We've had humans on the planet for 300,000 years, and we've had humans on the planet, according to James Hansen in a legal brief filed a couple of years ago, up to 2 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline. He has subsequently said that that was probably a little high. But let's go with it. So we've had habitat for humans at about 2 C above baseline. Earth came out of the Ice Age, and temperatures plateaued at 1.5 degrees above Ice Age, and maintained that plateau for a couple of thousand years, and then civilization started popping up. For the first time in 300,000 years of our species, conditions were right. It was a little warmer than an Ice Age, and the temperature stabilized for an extended period of time. That allowed us to grow grains and subsequently store and distribute those grains at large scale. It's difficult for me to imagine humans surviving that just because our habitat would go away. And then we go up to 6 or 7 degrees by 2100, up to 5 C by 2050, up to 6 C by 2050. The hits keep coming. And very recently, as in a couple of days ago, BP and Shell indicate they're planning for catastrophic 5 degrees C warming above the 1750 baseline. So publicly, they support the Paris Agreement, whatever that means. But privately, they're planning, and I'm not sure how you plan. How do we plan to make money if there's nobody to sell our gas to? I suspect the primary reason that government officials are not telling you anything is because they don't want to spark a stampede. Business as usual is the way to make money and to keep the masses pacified. Civilization is the new religion. So taking issue with the set of living arrangements is not going to be well received, and no politician is going to promote anything otherwise. Reminded of my favorite line from that philosopher, Mike Tyson. You might have known him as a boxer, but now he's a public speaker and something of a philosopher. And his famous line is, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. So I don't know what they're planning for, but I think at 5C there's going to be a big old punch in the face.
A lot of our young people are feeling that punch in the face even now as we see 1.5C receding in the rearview mirror.
James Hansen and a couple of dozen co-authors conclude in a paper in Earth System Dynamics. So this is the referee journal literature. This is incredibly conservative referee journal literature. And they conclude by headline, Young People's Burden. I hate this paper already. I hate what it stands for. Young People's Burden. Requirement of negative CO2 emissions. We need to unburn the fossil fuels. Wait, what did he just say? We need to unburn the fossil fuels. We need to capture carbon at such large scale and turn it back into fossil fuels and stick them back in the ground. That's fantasy technology. To put that on young people, to say this is the young people's burden, you have a requirement to fix the mess we made? Have we no integrity as an entire generation?
I so appreciate the scary honesty of your approach to our youth. After your presentations, you offer an open-ended, anything-goes Q&A session, and I'm grateful for the eloquence of this nameless young man. I'm sure he does indeed speak for his generation as well as for himself.
I'm the first of the Generation X. Are we concerned about these things that are happening on our planet? Well, abso-fucking-lutely, of course we are. I mean, every generation is concerned about this. So I want to bring up just one thing that's been going on my entire life. There's a Ben Harper song where he says, what good is a cynic with no better plan? I saw the Al Gore movie in 2007, and you know what my reaction was? It's like he brings this chair out, and he gets you to stand on the chair. Get up on this chair. Okay, good. You're up here standing on this chair. Oh, yeah, okay. That noose that's hanging off the ceiling there, yeah, put that around your neck. Okay, yeah, okay, awesome. There you go. You're standing on a chair. You got a noose around your neck. Okay, good luck with that. Bye-bye. And he walks out of the room. All my life, there's been people standing in front of me telling me that these horrible things are going on, and I know that they're going on or whatever, but where's the solution?
Problems have solutions. Predicaments don't. This is a predicament. It's not a problem. There's a solution. There's a 7.5 billion solution. The solution is in how you live every day. There is no societal level solution. Civilization is a heat engine. Turning off civilization heats the planet even faster. Do what you love. Do it well. I prefer to quote George Carlin. Scratch any cynic and you'll cover a disappointed idealist.
Carlin's words are certainly true of me. If there was ever a disappointed idealist, I'm it.
In Common Dreams, John Acheson writes, our aversion to doom and gloom is what's dooming us, not our acceptance of the disaster that we're headed for. And then the referee journal literature catches up in a paper in Psychological Science that is titled The Belief in a Favorable Future, and which concludes the belief in a favorable future actually prevents action. I'm not promoting inaction. I just think that we are in the midst of a predicament, not a problem. Problems have solutions. Problems are in math books, and you turn to the back and the answers are there. Predicaments don't have solutions. The protagonist in the latest Mad Max Fury Road turns to another actor and he says, I can't believe I'm saying this in my out loud voice. Hope is a mistake. If you can't fix what's broken, it'll make you crazy. Hope and fear are our projections into the future. We hope it's going to be a good world. We fear it's going to be a bad world. Why? Why don't we live here? Why don't we live now, trying to make a difference in our lives and the lives of the people around us? I hear all the time that I've given up hope. Yes, I have. If you look at the definition of hope, it actually says wishing for an outcome over which one has no agency. It's wishful thinking. It's as bad as fear. The flip sides of the I don't know the future coin.
Before we get into your advice for what we should do with our remaining time in this dimension, I'd like to offer our listeners a brief review of a section of your presentation under the heading Lies My Culture Told Me.
Our response within this culture to this information is to adhere to notions like human superiority and the infinite growth paradigm, because that's all we've ever heard. And nobody says it out loud. These are the assumptions that the culture whispers in our ears. Nobody goes around saying humans are superior. We just assume it away with the language. After all, what do we call non-human animals? We call them animals. We don't call humans animals. If we do, it's an insult. That guy's such an animal. Occasionally, somebody like a biologist will say there are non-human animals, sometimes called lesser animals or lower animals.
animals make their debut as part of nature's milieu, and a terminal route via overshoot, that's part of nature too. Hee-haw!
The infinite growth paradigm, we just assume we can have infinite growth on a finite planet because it's always worked so far. I mean, every generation has more, has better than the previous generation. And we just assume that's going to happen forever. Now, forever is a long time, especially toward the end. So I'm not sure I'd be buying that. Every time you go to a bank, open a checking account or a savings account, does anybody ever tell you you're going to get negative interest rate? No. No, they tell you that in the future, your money's going to be worth more if you put it in the bank because it's going to accumulate interest. You just bought into the infinite growth paradigm. More is better. Of course, we hear that all the time. That's how things are going to be for future generations. This civilization, like others, monetizes essentially everything. Everything we can manage to monetize, we do. Of course, we pay for the water that comes out the taps. It's absurd to think otherwise. Of course, you have to pay your water bill. Of course, you have to pay for food when you go to the store, grocery store. But until a few thousand years ago, for the first, say, 290,000 years of Homo sapiens on the planet, nobody paid for any of that. You went around, you picked up the food off the ground. You drank the water from the streams. I wouldn't recommend that today. It's bad for your health.
Living's a fatal pursuit for creatures, however astute. Though we were the master at getting there faster, as a rule, species do overshoot. Hee-haw!
When I was in New Zealand about this time last year, New Zealand air was being sold for 85 cents a breath in Beijing, in steel cans. No way that pays. But we monetize everything, including the air we breathe. We monetize songbirds. We monetize all life on the planet, because we treat all life on the planet as resources for us. There again, buying into the myth of human superiority. This civilization, like others, is characterized by endemic racism, endemic misogyny, and endemic monetary disparity leading to poverty, forced upon some but not others.
And as Benji is implying, all of these rest on a foundation of population overshoot.
For more than 20 years in the classroom, I pointed out to my students that no significant problem could be improved by adding more people to the planet. And all of my students went on to have children. And I'm not attached to that outcome, or it would have driven me insane.
Hee-haw!
Thanks. When I was 19 in 1979, Limits to Growth had been out for 7 years. I had taken a college biology class, and I recognized that there's no significant problem on the planet that can be improved by adding more people to the mix. I'm not making any sort of judgment about people who have children, because fighting evolution is tough. You know, overcoming evolution by natural selection, which screams at us to procreate every waking minute of our day, that's hard. That's tough to overcome. Flight or fight, have children, accumulate material possessions. That's what evolution is telling us all to do. And to not do that makes you some sort of weirdo who doesn't have kids and who lives off-grid, leaving a six-figure job behind voluntarily to opt out of society. So I'm crazy on two fronts. There are people choosing not to have children or choosing to have fewer children. And when I first started talking about this in my classrooms 29 years ago, there were half as many people on the planet as there are now. So you can tell what a swimming success I've been. And if you have children, and almost everybody does, so only the people who have kids have genes that get passed on. Those of us who choose otherwise don't get our genes passed on, so we're selected against for all future generations. So if you do have children, again, no judgment, no blame. Evolution is essentially impossible to overcome. I'm not judging or blaming or shaming anybody for having children. I love my former students. Some of them have 3 kids. I don't go up to one of my best friends, Jake, and criticize him every time I see him for having 3 children. That's obscene. Find your tribe. Love them hard. That includes your children.
You know, overshoot needs no conflation with problems of civilization. Humans aren't distinct. Species all go extinct, whatever their organization. Yeehaw!
Edward Abbey wrote, "Civilization, like an airplane in flight, remains aloft only as it is moving forward." What that means is every civilization grows and dies. Civilizations don't grow or die. They grow and they die because they can't sustain the growth anymore. We are at limits to growth, as pointed out by the Club of Rome in their famous report from 1972. We're bumping up against those limits. So what happens? The airplane falls out of the sky. Civilization collapses. They don't go slowly into the night. Throughout the history of civilizations, hundreds of them documented now,
essentially none descended gradually. The collapse. Where I lived for many years in New Mexico, the Membres culture discovered corn. This is approximately 880 years ago. And 20 years later, to the year, 20 years later, they collapsed. Very few survivors. Very few Membres survivors persisted 20 years. At year 17, they were starting to eat the seed corn. In 17 years, they had overpopulated the region to such an extent that they depended completely upon a superb crop of corn this year. 20 years after they discovered corn, the civilization collapsed. A few survivors returned and never grew corn again. They had a choice as a society. We don't. Because if we turn off civilization, the planet heats even faster. And there's all those nuclear power facilities that are going to melt down catastrophically if we turn off the switch. Our response to all of this information is we go over the cliff looking at our smartphones. It's not that I'm not guilty like everybody else. I bought into the whole thing. I held out as long as I could before I got a flip phone. But then it's just this one-way road, right? This whole technological runaway train. Just because I refuse to buy a flip phone doesn't mean that flip phones don't exist. Doesn't mean that there aren't children making 4 cents a day working in a factory in China. I didn't stop any of that, whether I buy the phone or not. That's going on. So I suspect the point of no return was somewhere around harnessing fire. Then we invented language that allows us to communicate across the miles, and then we built nuclear power plants to boil water. I like what Farley Mowat says about this. We're under some gross misconception that we're a good species going somewhere important. The last minute we'll correct our errors and God will smile on us. It's delusion. You cannot spend 50 generations shitting in your own nest and not end up with poop on your feathers. It's just not going to happen. And the delusion goes back a long time. God will smile on us. The last minute will correct our errors. The last minute was centuries ago. Maybe only decades with respect to climate change, but still a long time ago. And there's no blame here. What good does it do to blame your parents or their parents or your great-great-great-grandparents? Everybody was just born into captivity. They just showed up at this certain time in history, and everybody was driving cars. And so, of course, I got a car, and then we got smartphones, and what are you going to do? We were born into captivity just like everybody else. We didn't get to vote on it. And all of our predecessors bought into the infinite growth paradigm, too. It all seemed like a good idea at the time. What we face are two paradoxes. First paradox, civilization is a heat engine driving us to extinction. No matter how we power it, solar panels, wind turbines, wave power, whatever you want to do, civilization itself is a heat engine, pure and simple. Because of something we only recently have discovered, the concept of global dimming or the aerosol masking effect, terminating civilization heats the planet even faster. That's the first paradox. The next paradox is, according to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, only geoengineering will get us out of this mess. We have to apply geoengineering at large scale, and no evidence indicates geoengineering will work. If we only faced one of these two paradoxes, I'd say we're screwed. But we're facing two. We have to keep the heat engine of civilization on, or we go extinct. If we keep it on, we go extinct. And we have to employ geoengineering, or we're in really bad shape, and if we employ geoengineering, it won't work, it'll make things worse.
Hasn't our response to the information you are presenting improved at all over the years?
I toured New Zealand 3 times, about 2 years apart each time. And in 2012, all I got was people who yelled at me. In 2014, I'm giving a talk, and there's two older men sitting in the back. And they get up, and they shuffle to the front, and they get to the door behind me. The guy turns around, and he says, "Don't listen to a fucking word he says. He's an asshole." Then he flips me off, and he goes out the door. In New Zealand, where people are polite! And nobody did that in 2016, so I think everybody's hearing it nicely. It is becoming more clear when I first started talking about this in my out loud voice in 2012. I met some resistance. Like, I'm surprised I haven't been killed yet.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
As Sequitur's producer, I have a deep interest in this human tendency to shoot the messenger. At best, truth-telling is a fruitless endeavor, and at worst, it can exact a terrible price.
Tim Garrett is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah, wrote a distinguished paper that was published in the journal Climatic Change in November 2009, in which he points out that because of the laws of thermodynamics, which he actually calls the laws of thermodynamics, not the strong suggestions of thermodynamics, but the actual laws of thermodynamics, only turning off civilization prevents runaway climate change. The paper was written in 2007, contributed to 10 different journals, finally published by a very, very brave editor, Stephen Schneider, who at his time was on his deathbed. In November 2009, immediately pulled from publication because academics said, oh, you can't threaten civilization. That sounds too scary. I'm going to lose my job and my money. So it was pulled from publication for 14 months, and finally it appeared officially in February 2011. But it only appeared because the journal ran responses from two university research groups, neither of which took issue with the fundamental tenet that the laws of thermodynamics mean that only turning off civilization prevents runaway climate change. Well, I reached this conclusion long before Garrett did, to figure out that civilization is driving to extinction 150 to 200 species a day. You don't have to be a genius to know that civilization itself, the set of living arrangements, is the cause of the sixth mass extinction on planet Earth, is causing the soils to wash away into the ocean, is fouling the air and dirtying the water. You don't have to do anything except use your eyes and look around to realize that turning every single piece of the planet into what we call resources so that we can go faster, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that might lead someplace adverse. So I took action. I moved to a place in rural southern New Mexico I started developing in 2007. I called the Mud Hut, and I put a bunch of solar panels on a straw bale house, built an outdoor kitchen, and built a kiln for making biochar so I could actually keep the carbon from entering the air and put it into the ground where it does some good, and used the sun for heating and learned how to grow food and preserve the food. And I document this in my 2011 book, Walking Away from Empire. I actually left. I abandoned civilization because I knew it was an unmitigated disaster. And I thought, I'm a professor at a distinguished institution, and I have all of these credentials behind me, and so if I just set this example, everybody will follow me. Nobody followed. I started down this path in 2004 and finally made the break from university life in early 2009. We didn't know anything about global dimming. Now we know that global dimming, or the aerosol masking effect, puts an umbrella over the planet. We all know about the greenhouse effect. We put up these greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and chlorofluorocarbons and ozone and water vapor and a list of a couple of dozen more. And those trap radiation, those trap the long wave radiation especially, and heat up the planet. So they act as something like a blanket. The sun comes in, it shines on the planet, it warms up the planet, and the blankets keep piling on every time we crank up the internal combustion engine. Every time we turn on a light switch, we're burning more coal and oil and putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere that trap heat. Well, at the same time, we're putting up particulates into the atmosphere, most notably sulfates associated with the sulfur in the poor quality coal that comprises most of the coal. So we put those particulates up in the air, and they serve as something of an umbrella. So remember, Garrett's paper was finally published in February 2011. We didn't know anything about global dimming in terms of the refereed journal literature at that point. The first paper by Hansen and colleagues, James Hansen, appears in December 2011. The next paper comes out in May 2013 and indicates up to about a 3°C increase in temperature once we remove the umbrella associated with putting industrial particulates into the atmosphere. The planet will heat up catastrophically up to about 3°C in a matter of weeks. Very, very short period of time. So here's the first paradox. We can keep putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and stacking on the blankets when it's already a hot summer day, or we can remove them and the planet heats up catastrophically quickly. The Guardian, in a paper by Oliver Tickell, published in August of 2008, by headline says, on a planet 4°C hotter, all we can prepare for is extinction. And again, this is 4°C above the 1750 baseline. About 17.5 degrees global average temperature. Collapse of civilization causes the temperature to rise even faster than it otherwise would have. So this takes us to 4.5°C in a matter of weeks. Already at a very slow, gradual increase in global average temperature, thousands of species, including vertebrates, lag behind in their ability to adapt. That's with slow climate change. We're at the leading edge of abrupt climate change right now. When could that crash come? Tom Hartmann predicted that it would happen in 2016 with his book, The Crash of 2016. I don't think he was wrong. I think he was ahead of his time, like he is on so many matters. Civilization cannot be maintained forever. This set of living arrangements, like every civilization before it, is going to fall. The only question is over what span of time. It could happen in a matter of weeks, days, months. Nobody knows. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their vaunted fifth assessment, officially released in 2014, but heavily leaked late in the previous year, global warming is irreversible without massive geoengineering of the atmosphere's chemistry. And so we've passed the point of no return, they say. We need to geoengineer. We need to do something to cool the planet. Truth Out comes out shortly thereafter and says the intergovernmental report leaves hopes hanging on fantasy technology because we don't know how to geoengineer the planet beyond doing it the wrong way, which we've been doing for a long time. We know how to do that. Every time we turn on the engine, every internal combustion engine, that geoengineers a planet. Every time we put a spade in the ground and turn over the shovel, it releases a little carbon dioxide and a little methane. We know how to make it go one way. We don't know how to make it go the other way. Further indicating that geoengineering is not a viable response is the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, in a report published 2.5 years ago in a European body of similar stature, concluding that that's not going to work. So we have to geoengineer, but geoengineering will not work. Whoopsie. As if two paradoxes aren't enough, we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction on planet Earth. The paper that points this out, authored, of course, by conservation biologists who understand speciation, extinction, and habitat, concludes by headline that the accelerated modern human-induced species losses are already underway. This is more than 2 years ago. We are entering the sixth mass extinction. The lead author, Gerardo Ceballos, in an interview that accompanied release of that paper, says life would take many millions of years to recover, and our species itself would likely disappear early on. Of course, Gerardo understands that we are incredibly dependent upon thousands of other species. We cannot drive all those species to extinction and get out of here alive. Conservation biologists know this. They know about the intricate web that links us together with the living planet. Then, 2 years later, earlier this summer, in a title in one of the most prestigious journals in all of the referee journal literature, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or as graduate students like to call it, PNAS, P-N-A-S. The headline, the title of the paper is Biological Annihilation. This is an unbelievably conservative journal. It's an outlet that doesn't take terms like biological annihilation at a whim. Biological annihilation via the ongoing sixth mass extinction signaled by vertebrate population losses and declines. The abstract includes the line, this biological annihilation underlines the seriousness for humanity of Earth's ongoing sixth mass extinction. In the final sentence of the paper, a few pages later, all signs point to ever more powerful assaults on biodiversity, painting a dismal picture of the future of life, including human life. Even if we didn't have the damned if you do and damned if you don't from thermodynamics and global dimming, even if we didn't have all that going on, we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction on planet Earth. To think that we can somehow avoid causing the extinction of our favorite species after we cause the extinction of 150 to 200 species every single day, that's from a United Nations report published August 2010, that's asinine. All that's not bad enough. There's a paper, again, in the incredibly conservative referee journal literature, co-authored by four authors, three of them with the United States Naval Postgraduate College, so a fairly conservative institution, publishing an annual review paper in Earth and Planetary Sciences 2012 titled The Future of Arctic Ice. And they point out, given the estimated trend and the volume estimate for October and November of 2007, one can project that at this rate, it would take only nine years beyond 2007, or until 2016 plus or minus 3 years, to reach a nearly ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summer. And this is important. Ice-free Arctic, by definition, includes up to 15% of the Arctic Ocean covered by ice, or up to 1 million square kilometers of ice. So when people talk about an ice-free Arctic, they don't necessarily mean every last little bit of ice is going to disappear. It's just almost all disappeared. Because it's really hard to identify those pieces of ice that are tucked away in the nooks and crannies and the coves and the fjords all over in the Arctic where there's just not that great of satellite data management going on anyway. So, Arctic ice is absolutely huge. President of Finland, in a joint press conference at the White House on the 28th of August of this year, says if we lose the Arctic, and he's talking about the Arctic ice, if we lose the Arctic, we lose the globe. That is reality. In other words, if we lose the Arctic ice, we lose habitat for humans at the global level. I'm stunned it hasn't happened yet. We have dodged 5 bullets. The volume of ice in the Arctic is lower than it's ever been. Do we get through next year? Do we get through 2016 plus or minus 3 years, taking us till 2019? Maybe. Maybe. There's a lot of inexplicable variation in complex systems, like how much ice is in the Arctic this year. Do we avoid it through 2020? It would very, very, very much surprise me. But I was stunned we got through this year. I've been surprised before. I'm open to miracles. I don't think we've ever had one, but I'm open to the idea. Almost everybody I speak to wants to know their expiration date. But we don't know. You're drawing your last, what you think is your last breath, and you think this is probably it. Oh, I got another one. Early in 1989, Edward Abbey, the desert anarchist, asked his friends to haul him out in a sleeping bag into his backyard in Tucson, Arizona. And he said, this is it. This is it. I'm going to die tonight. So haul me out in my backyard and I can look up at the skies in my sleeping bag. They took him out there and they left him out. They sat with him for a while and then they left him. And he's looking up at the sky. Pretty soon he's like, hey guys, this isn't it. Can you come get me? So they hauled him back in his house and he died a few weeks later. But this was 7 years after his doctor told him that he only had weeks to live. So my point, and I do have one, is that we don't know. I think we're close to the end. I still floss my teeth. You don't know. So it'd be really cool if we had an expiration date on the bottom of our foot that told us when we were going to die, but instead it's like, I can't read that. It's like every once in a while you buy a can of peaches or something from the store, and the expiration date is just so fuzzy, you can't really tell what it is. If you catch it at the store, you put it right back. If you catch it when you're home, since you already spent $1.50 on that, you open it anyway. The bottom line here, the primary point, is that we are incredibly clever. There's no question about that. But we still need habitat to survive. We call ourselves Homo sapiens. Our subspecies is sapiens too. Homo sapiens sapiens. We're twice wise. But I don't think we are. I think we're clever. So I give us the name Homo calidus. Calidus in Latin means clever. I think we're really clever. But without habitat, even Homo calidus can't get out of this one. We might persist in the International Space Station. We might persist in nuclear submarines eating Soylent Green. We might persist in caves or in bunkers. But for how long? Do you want to be the last person alive? If to be the last person alive, you're eating canned peaches with the dead bodies of like-minded sociopaths hanging out there in your bunker with you? Life will take many millions of years to recover. That's been the case with each of the previous 5 mass extinction events. You might have bought into the infinite growth paradigm, but you're still not going to live millions of years. We're not going to see the development of complex life on Earth into a verdant green planet again after the 6th mass extinction is complete. The Guardian concludes via headline on a planet 4C hotter, 4C above the 1750 baseline. All we can prepare for is extinction. That seems a little contrary to the precautionary principle to me, to assume we're going to make it that high when we've only ever had up to 2C above baseline in the past. But maybe. We don't know. We don't know when we're going to go extinct, and the last person on the planet won't know. If you're the last person on the planet, you will never know that you're the last person on the planet. You'll know that you have a lot of time to read. The television hasn't worked for a while, but you have all this time in your hands. There's nobody around, but you won't know. You won't know there's somebody on the other side of the planet who's alive. The best we can do is rely upon the existing information to tell us when we might die. As a species, all species go extinct. As individuals. I don't think it makes a big difference where you are. At some point in the not-too-distant future, we're all going to die, and the last person alive will be in a bunker with cans of peaches, and I don't want to live like that. An analysis done by Sam Carana, who is really, really smart, middle of 2016, projects global average temperature rise of more than 10 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline by the middle of 2026. So he looks out 10 years and he adds up all these contributors that are already locked in. And he concludes we're headed for the highest global average temperature in the last 2 billion years. I say he's really smart, by the way, because he or she is 2 or 3 people. And we don't know who it is. It's probably climate scientists who are smart enough to not reveal their name so they don't lose their jobs or support for their jobs. So they put out some amazing stuff, but you'll never see them on television because they won't reveal their identities. I did my own analysis. I took the most conservative possible approach I could take to Karana's assessment, and I concluded we're at least 8.7 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline within the next decade. That's enormous. Far faster than the Great Dying. The Great Dying was the worst of the previous five mass extinction events. It occurred 252.2 million years ago when the temperature rose from Ice Age to beyond hothouse. The most common temperature observed on Earth over the last 2 billion years is 22 degrees Celsius. We overshot and went to 23 degrees Celsius, the highest temperature observed on planet Earth in the last 2 billion years. And that happened over a span of somewhere between roughly 1,000 years and roughly 20,000 years. And we're headed there in a decade. This was the worst of the mass extinction events. More than 90% of the species on the planet went extinct. Essentially, all complex life disappeared, and it took many millions of years for there to be complex life again. It was microbes. It was bacteria. It was fungi. It's a small world, after all. But I'm not suggesting that it's going to take that long for us to reach that kind of temperature. Sam Krannik comes out later, and instead of just adding up the contributors, instead of adding up the 10-year lag in maximum heating associated with carbon dioxide emissions, and then we'll add up the water vapor effect, which is nearly instantaneous, and then we'll add on the methane release, taking a very conservative approach, and so on. And we get to a really high number in 10 years. If instead we take an exponential approach, as Karana did earlier this year, we get there in 4 years. I'm also not suggesting that you have 4 years or that you have 8 years. I don't know your expiration date, but the planet could warm up well beyond the point at which it has harbored humans in the past in a very short period of time. Natalia Shukova, along with her partner Igor Samelatov, have been studying methane release in the field in the Arctic Ocean for many years now. At the European Geophysical Union meetings in late 2008, they concluded that a release of up to 50 gigatons of methane hydrate is, quote, highly possible for abrupt release at any time. And they conclude that would add 1.3 degrees Celsius to the temperature. That would be enough to collapse civilization because we can no longer grow grains at scale. And that would add up to another 3C the following spring or summer when we're harvesting the grains. And this paper, which was only an abstract, was only an oral presentation. It's supported by later data by the same research team in Nature Communications earlier this year, and then with a paper out about a month ago, in fact, a completely separate research team reaches a similar conclusion. So there's been some question in the academic community about whether such a burst of methane, 50 gigaton burst of methane, is even possible. And now two research groups have confirmed this year that it is indeed possible and is likely to have happened in the not too distant past. So it could be that we have an ice-free Arctic and that leads to that explosion of methane that causes the whole system, the whole house of cards to come down, and we're at 6C in a very short period of time. So I've had many, many people interview me and then interview other people, more mainstream climate scientists. And as an aside here, climate scientists almost uniformly have degrees in astronomy and physics. None of them have a degree in biology, much less conservation biology. So they think we can tech our way out of anything. I've had lots of interviews, and then the interviewer goes on and interviews some other climate scientists. And then they tell me off the record that Professor X agrees with everything I'll say, but they won't say it on the air. So I get this kind of feedback every month from somebody who interviews people who are unwilling to tell what they know is true. That's why do you think Sam Karana is Sam Karana? It's two or three people, and they're not telling us their names. Because if they did, you'd never hear from them again. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a climate scientist who doesn't know about my work, at least in the United States and Canada. It's hard for those people to avoid knowing me, but they would never admit knowing me. I have received heavily redacted documents from the intelligence community of the United States indicating that I had been surveilled since at least 1996 and that I had an NSA contracted spy in my classroom in 2005. I did an interview with a guy, he goes under the cover Mark Austin. After he retired on a Friday, I interviewed him for my radio show on Tuesday. And he spilled a lot of stuff that seemed really freaky. And I don't know what to make of that anymore. Because, you know, that could go two ways. If he's a spy, or if he was a spy that retired 4 days ago, then he was paid to lie. And if he wasn't a spy, then he was lying about being a spy. So I'm not sure what to make of that. So based on the documentation I've received, I think I was probably surveilled for a pretty long period of time. There was information included there that It would be hard to get through public channels. Are the people at the top lying to us? Yeah, they're paid to lie. If they told the truth, the house of cards would come down in 5 minutes. Why are they lying to us? Why would they tell the truth? Why do governments exist? Why do civilizations exist? Why do we have this set of living arrangements? Take a look at the money. Follow the money. We're lied to every day. How do you tell if a politician's lying? His lips are moving.
Hee-haw!
The NSA has been collecting information at that security facility in southern Utah since at least 2000. Every keystroke every American types in Microsoft Word or any Microsoft program and Apple is recorded at this storage facility in southern Utah. Tim Garrett's paper was written in 2007. It indicates that civilization is a heat engine. They knew that before I knew that. They knew that in 2007 when he was typing it. Do you think anybody's going to run on the campaign of shutting down civilization? There isn't 1% of the people in the United States and Canada combined who want to terminate civilization. Because it's awesome. Are you kidding me? We get smartphones. We get to drive around. We get to fly in airplanes. We get all these privileges. And all it costs is brown people dying and grinding the living planet into dust, fouling the air and dirtying water, and all those other inconveniences. But Jesus, we get smartphones? Are you kidding? We'll trade genocide for that. We always have. Everybody knows that who's paying even the slightest bit of attention. You think the politicians don't know that? I think they probably do. There are things we won't ask them to do. There's a great movie called 3 Days of the Condor, came out in 1973. Watch the final scene. We're there today. Pentagon declared earlier this year that American empire is actually collapsing. You think the U.S. empire is going to collapse and not take everybody else with it? You know that's the case. The United States has been playing this game for 100 years. This paper in New Scientist, civilization is more precarious than we realized. The date's April 2008, and then along kept September 2008. House of Cards comes this close to falling down. It's more precarious than we think. You know, every civilization is 9 meals away from being done. That's how much food the big box grocery store has, is enough to feed people in the area for 3 days. I'm not saying that civilization is going to collapse in 3 days. I kind of hope it doesn't, personally. I grew up in the United States on Walt Disney, so I'd be remiss to not leave you with a positive message. So I do indeed have a version with a happy ending. We get to die. Wait, maybe I didn't say that quite right. The happy ending is, yes, we will all die. But we get to live. Do you know the odds against you being here? Against this collection of DNA coming together in physical form? Do you know what the odds against that are? They exceed the odds against plucking a single atom at random from the entire universe. As Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist, says, in the face of these stupefying odds, it is you and I that are privileged to be here, privileged with eyes to see where we are and brains to wonder why. But I don't know when I'm going to die. It'd be nice to know. In the absence of knowing, I have a few pieces of advice. You don't need to take them. It doesn't bother me. For 21 years, my students never took my advice about not having children. I'm not attached to the outcome here. I suggest that even when we're dying, we remain calm. We recognize that nothing is under our control. I mean, really little things. Like, what if I said, Jesus, you're wearing that in public? And if I did that every day to this guy, it'd ruin his day. Pretty soon he'd avoid me. So we do have a little bit of influence, if not control, over people's day, the people in our circle, right? The people we see on a regular basis, our family, our friends. So remain calm. Nothing is under control, especially not in the big picture. Secondly, I promote the pursuit of excellence, which I've come to conclude is probably a mistake. There are no external rewards for excellence. None. There is no way you're going to get a raise in a culture of mediocrity by pursuing excellence. You're just going to piss off your coworkers and maybe even your supervisor, who's going to talk to you, pull you off to the side and say, you know, you're making everybody else look bad. I still suggest the pursuit of excellence, however you define that, because at the end of it all, and even at the end of every day, you only have to face one person. You don't have to talk to your supervisor. You don't have to talk to your spouse. You don't have to check in with anybody except one person, the face in the mirror. That's the only person you have to face every moment of every day. And then the pursuit of love isn't such a bad idea. So these are the three things I suggest. We don't know how long we have. For all I know, we might survive a global average temperature rise up to 10 degrees C above the 1750 baseline in a span of a decade. It could happen. How would I know? We're still here. We're not all dead yet. I know only two things. You're going to die, and our species is going to go extinct. I don't know the timeline for either one. I suggest that remaining calm, that pursuing excellence and doing what we love, that's not bad advice regardless. I suggest we take some advice from your four-legged friends. Roll around on the ground.
Okay, that's my cue. Since I can't show my listeners the cute cartoon that you use for this part of your presentation, I'm going to read a piece that I picked up at a nonviolent communication training 10 years ago, and it's called If a Dog Were Your Teacher by an unknown author. If a dog were your teacher, these are some of the lessons you might learn. When loved ones come home, always run to greet them. Allow the experience of fresh air and the wind in your face to be pure ecstasy. Practice obedience when it's in your best interest. Let others know when they've invaded your territory. Take naps and stretch before rising. Run, romp, and play daily. Thrive on attention and let people touch you and scratch you all over. Avoid biting when a simple growl or even a lick will do. On warm days, stop to lie on your back on the grass. On hot days, drink lots of water and lay under a shady tree. When you're happy, dance around and wag your entire body. No matter how often you're scolded, don't buy into the guilt thing and pout. Run right back and make friends. Delight in the simple joy of a long walk. Eat with gusto and enthusiasm and stop when you've had enough. Be loyal. Never pretend to be something you're not. If what you want lies buried, dig until you find it. When someone is having a bad day, be silent, sit close by, and nuzzle them gently.
There's a lot of distractions out there. A lot of them are purposeful distractions. So keep your eye on being in the moment, on pursuing excellence, on pursuing love, and being you. So all the other jobs are taken.
Yeehaw!
I'm trying to pursue excellence in what I do. I'm trying to do what I love. I'm trying to be fully present. I'm trying to act like my dog. I talk about the unthinkable. I've lived on Pauline's property for about 16 months, and we haven't had a week go by when we haven't had visitors because some people want to come have the conversation that nobody else is willing to have. And I think that's awesome. It's weird, but I like talking about your death and mine and where that goes because it goes everywhere. Once you have the conversation about death, suddenly all the taboos are gone. There are things in this culture that we just don't talk about. Death, dying, grief, grieving. We don't talk about sex. We don't talk about bodily functions. But once you start talking about this stuff, people will talk about anything. And it's amazing and it's wonderful. You know, we can look back through all of these so-called prophecies, including the Christian Bible and the Quran and blah, 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 all these other things that, depending upon how you interpret them, tell us how to live. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any of them that tell us to do this. Any of them. Sometimes there's a woman of a certain age who sits next to me on a plane. The poor woman is trapped in the window seat, and I got the aisle. And she invariably brings up abrupt climate change leading to near-term human extinction. Surprising how many people know about this. And so we have this conversation, and she invariably tells me that God wouldn't let that happen. God would not let us go extinct. And I point out that the universe is 13.8 billion years old, and our species is 300,000 years old, and the universe has been really, really patient if this is all about us. And besides which, do you think God is going to be all that impressed when he comes back and looks around and sees what we've done with the place? You know, I think it was in Genesis that it was pointed out we're supposed to steward the planet. Last time I read, steward was not synonymous with fuck it up. Remain calm. Nothing is under control. Fear and hope, the twin sides of the I don't know the future coin. So I'm going to fear the future. I'm going to hope for something to happen. No, let's live here now. Let's take right actions, respect, and act kindly. The people around us. We could do worse than that. I have most of my life.
You're listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
As I was reviewing the recordings of your presentation, I noticed you keep dancing around the issue of suicide. You mention it, You're even owning that you're thinking about it, studying on it, and then you hide behind a wall of humor, or you talk about other people and things that you want to be able to offer to them for their comfort. Listen to this, for example.
I know I'm going to die. I live in a place, the Central American country of Belize, where a habitat is bound to disappear faster than almost any place else on Earth. So I'm going to set an example. Again, I'm going to die first because of abrupt climate change. The instant I die, I'm setting an example. He did it. He died from abrupt climate change. He was right after all. I'll do anything to be right.
See what I mean?
I'm actually contemplating my exit. Unlike most people, I think about suicide. Most people give that up after their teen years, right? And then if you're, quote, normal in the society, you never think about it again. I think about it all the time. Mostly I think about it for other people. We're building this four-room structure, and people say, what's the point of having this four-room structure with an art studio if you're going to die in a year or two or three or five? We're not just building the structure. We're building community. We're out there, side by side, pounding nails, sawing boards. Aristotle defined friendship as a relationship between people working together toward the common good. That's what defines friendship, not drinking buddies, friends. We're trying to build community here. What happens when the methane bomb goes off in the Arctic? What happens when we get to lethal wet bulb temperatures? We're also researching symptoms and treatments. 37 degrees Celsius, 100% relative humidity. You can't survive in that above ground, even if you get a fan blowing on you. Your organs boil in your skin. Higher temperatures means lower humidity, and you're still at lethal wet bulb temperatures. Well, it gets up above 100 degrees Fahrenheit all the time in Belize, where I live, and very humid. So it gets much more humid or much hotter. Then there's going to be people dropping all over the place. And already we've observed behavior of people acting erratically, and that's one of the symptoms of lethal wet bulb temperatures. People act like they're drunk. So I might not be able to prevent it in the end. For now, I can. We can say, why don't you take the rest of the day off, go hang out in the shade, maybe sit in the saltwater pool for a while, just cool your jets. But eventually, almost certainly, somebody's going to exhibit symptoms that cannot be overcome as a result of lethal wet bulb temperatures. I'd rather know why this guy who's not drinking is acting drunk. I'd like to know why they're exhibiting symptoms consistent with lethal wet bulb temperatures, even if I can't do anything about it. Because even if I don't have any therapies to try, I still will be able to know what's going on with this person and realize that they are not going crazy, that they're not drunk, that they're exhibiting the symptoms, and it might kill them and it might kill me, but I'm still going to remain calm. That's not under my control. Internally, of course, I'm freaking out. My friends are dying in front of me, but I'm not going to display that because that would not improve anything.
I really want to get back to you. You say you're contemplating your own exit. You have moved to Belize, so you're right on the front line. You said very distinctly that you're going to set an example and drop dead from lethal wet bulb.
That would be a leading cause of mortality where I am. That and hunger, I suspect, will be the two leading causes of human mortality, living as close to the equator as I do. So I'm not absolutely certain when or how I'll die, but I suspect most of the people in Belize will die from one of those two causes.
And you think that you would hang out and wait for that to happen so that you can die from climate change?
Well, when it gets to that point, and I'm seeing people around me experiencing lethal wet bulb temperatures and hunger, I don't know what I'll do. But if people around me are suffering, and it appears that I will be suffering as well, then I think at this point I would opt for an early exit rather than sustain the suffering. But I don't know because I'm not there yet. So far, I'm still about 10 pounds overweight, and I'm experiencing no serious loss of judgment. Okay, maybe I should rephrase that. I'm not experiencing what I can routinely identify as symptoms associated with organ failure. How's that? And so far, it's a great run. And I know that in the not-too-distant future, it won't be very pleasant for me and the people around me. What will I do then? Well, as I say in my presentations lately, I'm contemplating my early exit. That doesn't mean I've reached a decision, and I suspect I won't reach a decision until the last few minutes of my life.
So you're determined to stay in the moment, is what I'm hearing.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, one of the reasons I dance around the issue is that I don't know yet what I will do. And I don't want to encourage the ongoing libel, slander, and character defamation that I'm actually promoting suicide, or that I'm even promoting near-term human extinction, or that I'm promoting abrupt climate change. I'm promulgating the evidence behind these things, but I'm certainly not telling people what to do in light of them.
I've been very distressed by the defamation that Robin Williams was subjected to posthumously because of people's attitude towards suicide. Robin Williams hanged himself in his home on 11 August 2014. He was 63 years old. He had Lewy body dementia, a motor form of dementia that mimics Parkinson's. But, you know, no, I'm not going to euphemize it and call it self-deliverance. You know, there are many reasons that people decide to end their lives, and suffering is only one of them. Some people are just plain tired. Some people just want to get out of the way so that their children can thrive. There are a number of different motivations. In preparation for doing this show, I've been reading about alleged animal suicides and the hypothesis that it's their looser self-concept that allows them to face that with such equanimity, because they're doing it on behalf of the species or the tribe or the clan or the pack or the herd or the pod. There's been significant work on whale suicide, for example.
And outside of this culture, outside of the society we inhabit, there's a healthy tradition of suicide in what we might call pre-civilized or uncivilized societies. So think about the elders in the Inuit who, when they come to the realization, or perhaps it's to the opinion, that they are more detrimental than they are helpful to their community, they take a walk. And taking a walk away from your tribe in that environment is lethal. Mm-hmm. So you go out, it's cold, you fall asleep. It certainly is not the worst way to die.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't tried it myself, although I've come very close to dying as a result of hypothermia. And there's essentially no suffering involved there. Obviously, I've never gone the whole way. The point here is that it's not just the non-human animals. It's human animals, too, who are taking these actions to benefit their community by stepping away from it. It's considered perfectly normal beyond the communities we inhabit.
What about kamikaze pilots? And what about our own GIs who were given suicide pills in case they would give away state secrets under torture? There are all kinds of state-sanctioned approval for suicide, historically and cross-culturally. The lunacy, the schizoid contradiction of a culture that spends trillions of dollars killing brown people and won't allow their own citizens sovereignty over their own life.
You're absolutely right. To be non-judgmental, to actually promote suicide in some cases, and then at the same time to conclude that there's something wrong with it, that it's immoral, that in fact in most states it is illegal.
I've got to correct you there. It is not illegal anywhere. It is illegal to assist someone
right.
Suicide. Suicide is not illegal. It's just strongly, strongly forbidden for religious reasons and social reasons, but not legal reasons. Even that much is bizarre, that it should be illegal to help someone do something which is legal. It's the only instance of that paradox in our entire legal system.
Cognitive dissonance, anybody?
Yeah, right. Exactly. But no, it's legal to take your own life as long as nobody helps you. That's why all the how-to guides tell you to put that sentence in your note.
Right.
You arrive at the decision on your own, not under duress, and nobody helped you perform the act.
And I suspect most of us have a lot of people we would like to help commit suicide. But those people probably wouldn't let us get close to them.
Well, that's it. And that's when it's called murder, or on the other end of that spectrum, euthanasia, when someone else does it. That's why doctor-assisted suicide is an oxymoron.
Right. So yet another example of the craziness of this culture, or the lies the culture tells us, is that it's okay in some cases, and in fact considered noble in some cases, to commit suicide or to assist with somebody else committing suicide, although, as you pointed out, that's not legal. And yet, on the other hand, the culture is so quick to judge people who commit suicide, not having the slightest idea what their circumstances are, not knowing what's going on in their head, not knowing what's going on in their heart, not knowing how deeply they have thought about this.
Do you have a personal example of that that you'd be willing to share?
Michael C. Rupert.
Ah.
And he was a friend that I never met. We had many conversations, including one the night before he committed suicide, and he sent me an email message 15 to 30 minutes before he committed suicide.
What's interesting is that Michael C. Rupert killed himself on 13 April 2014, just 4 months before Robin Williams. He was also 63 years old.
So I think we were relatively close. I certainly would not judge him. Although many people judged me and claimed that I led to him committing suicide, that I was the cause of his suicide. And I think he was a lot smarter than that. I don't think he was depending upon me to make that decision for him. And I don't judge what he did. I talked to Jack Martin a year or two later. It was Jack's property on which Mike was living in a trailer. And the question came up, of course, do you believe Mike actually took his own life? And he said, well, I was the last person to see him alive, and I was the first person to see his brain scattered across the parking lot right over there. And I'd say there's at least a 99% chance he was operating under strictly his own influence. But, he says, we know that there are dark forces in the society, and they can make something look like suicide when it's not suicide. So he said, I would not rule out the possibility that somebody else pulled the trigger. Now, my take on that is, he pulled the trigger, but he didn't load the gun. He had been so tortured by the deep state of the United States and by the thoughts in his own head for such a long time that I don't doubt that he pulled the trigger. But he certainly had a lot of help getting to the mental state he was in. And I think I wasn't a primary contributor to getting him to that state.
Mm-hmm. But he got a lot of posthumous defamation from others, even in the Doomer community, yeah?
Absolutely. And so did I. I had at least two podcasters go on the air immediately and claim that I caused his suicide.
You think it was more a matter of despair over the oppression he was experiencing?
You know, I don't know. We never met. We talked on the phone several times. We corresponded by email. And I don't know what was going on in his head, but he had a serious affliction, which most people in this culture lack. He was afflicted with reality.
I was just going to guess, clear vision.
Yes. He knew where we were. And he knew what was coming. And in his own life, paradoxically enough, apparently things were going very well. I had been contacted shortly before his death by a producer, and Mike was about to get this big show launched in the Pacific Northwest. I believe it was in Seattle. And he had recently fallen in love with Jessie Ray. Of course, most people know that story. So it would appear that from the perspective of his personal life, his love life, from his professional life, the producer indicated to me that Mike wanted me to be the first feature on his new broadcast. It was a television show, and it was kind of a big deal. So it appeared that things were going well for him personally and professionally. And I think that's why Jesse had such a very difficult time with his suicide, because from her perspective, they were just getting started. And that's what raises the issue of whether he actually did pull the trigger, because it seemed that things were going swimmingly for Mike right up until his final hour. Mike was very careful with the notes he left behind to make sure that evidence was not tampered with, to make sure that a sufficient and reliable investigation was pursued in the wake of his death. So that's the paradox for me. It seemed like things were going great, and then it also seems like he planned very carefully for his own suicide. So I don't know, and we can't know. We can't insert ourselves into the heads of others, empathy notwithstanding. So I'm certainly not judging Mike Rupert or anybody else who opts to take their own life. And it's tough. I mean, Mike left behind a community of friends and followers who also had a significant affliction, that being reality. And so people were upset and they were sad. I was sad. Some people were hurt even. And I'm just trying to be very careful not to let the deaths of others have that sort of impact on me, especially if they choose their own route, if they choose their own demise.
It's a very tricky path to tread. It really is. I've had people warn me about doing this show just because it is such a tricky topic.
Of course. And I received so much blowback from that short post about suicide in Nature Past Last. And I point out very clearly there that I'm not encouraging anybody to commit suicide. I'm just encouraging people to think about what that means for their own lives and the lives of the people around them. And if they would just read that link by the individual who did commit suicide at the age of 60 on his 60th birthday, a 60-year-old man who thought deeply and wrote at length about why and when he was committing suicide on his 60th birthday. It's just a very, very thoughtful analysis of his own life and the privilege he enjoyed in his life. And so I just would encourage people to read that because he points out that it's not all as it seems, that right. We can't know what's in somebody else's mind as they're deciding to take their own life. So I just would encourage anybody listening to read that long essay.
That's why I wanted to point out that it's not always about desperation or despair. It's often a very rational decision of many, many years standing. And that is exactly why I think people like Robin Williams and Mike Rupert would choose to make their exit when they are at their peak, so that it can be clear that the motive was not, I had a fight with the old lady, or, you know, I lost my job. Those impulsive suicides are not what I'm interested in supporting. I want to support, as you, rational contemplation.
You know, and Robin Williams is a classic example. He was, after all, an entertainer. He was in this community in which one of the favorite phrases is, always leave him wanting more. Well, he did.
Yeah, he sure did.
He was at his peak, and he opted out before he experienced the decline, so that people would not ever be saying, you know, he used to be really good.
I was happy for him. I do believe in the life cycle as opposed to the lifeline, and that there's something of your nature that never really dies. And so I don't even like to talk about him in the past tense.
Right. Well, he certainly chose his own path. And
he certainly did.
Not a lot of people get to do that in the way that he did.
My intuitive grasp of where he was at, that he had always planned this, but didn't want to leave an orphan.
Right. Again, we can't know. We can't know what's going on in the other person's mind.
But it's a comfort to me to have that story.
Of course. And that's what we're left with in the wake of the deaths of the people around us by suicide or otherwise, is we're trying to find comfort. And this is why I think it's so important to complete the relationships we have with people before they disappear from our lives, through death, divorce, moving across the country, whatever means that we become separated from people. We have an opportunity to complete our relationship with them by saying the goodbyes every time we say goodbye and acting as if this is the time. And most people don't do that. We just assume that there will be another week, another month, another year that we'll see this person again. And so we don't truly live in the moment, especially with respect to our relationships.
And the flip side of that is, even if you've done the contemplation and you've decided that you're going to facilitate your own death, Reaper might beat you to it. You might get hit by a bus the next time you leave your house. As far as I'm concerned, the deal breaker is going to be when the internet goes down.
Mm-hmm.
I will readily admit that I can't live without this kind of interaction. I don't have people in my life. I live alone in high-density, low-income housing. What kind of connection do you think I have as far as community goes? This is it. This is it. I lose this and life is not worth living.
Well, fortunately, or unfortunately, for better and for worse, when I moved to Belize 16 months ago, I pretty much lost the internet. And unlike you and most other people, I get to have this conversation every day.
Yeah.
Because of Pauline and because of Sarah, who's traveling with me now, and because of Paul who comes and visits now and then, and because of the people I live with on Pauline's property in Belize, I get to have this conversation on a regular basis. It's not just those people sitting next to me on the airplane.
Yeah.
Those poor tortured souls.
And it's not that it's enjoyable, but it keeps you grounded.
Absolutely. It reminds me constantly what and who is important.
I mean, this is like, talk about privilege.
Right. Well, yeah. That's the thing. And I've been mentioning this relatively recently on tour as well. you know, all this technology is strictly a one-way street. Once we have this, nobody can imagine a world without this. We can't go the other way. You know, once we have this internet, as you pointed out, living without it becomes unthinkable.
Yeah.
And yet we lived without it for the first 300,000 years of the species Homo sapiens.
We got along just fine. I can imagine surviving without it, but that's not what I call life.
Exactly, right.
Because I was born in captivity, like you're saying. You know, I've had a computer in my home since 1982.
Bingo. And that's probably more than half the people on the planet at this point have had a computer in their homes their entire lives.
Or at least access, you know, internet cafe right down the street. I used to arrange global teleconferences for the nonviolent communication community. And we had people in Africa who actually had to plan a weekend excursion to the nearest town 20 miles away on foot to participate in our conference calls.
With the exception of the on-foot part, I know exactly how that feels.
There are people who really don't have that kind of access that we think mm-hmm. is so necessary. And I think about these people making these three-day plans to take part in a 90-minute conference call. You know, it's a major, major deal to connect, just to connect.
Right.
They also have local community, though, and I don't. And that's exactly. Very much the difference. I am in that dependent situation that they're not.
Right. And I have a wonderful human community surrounding me as well. And so that it takes me a half an hour to get to a place where we can have this conversation, it doesn't ruin my life, right? Because mm-hmm. I have these people around me every day.
Yeah. I've been looking for that for 20 years, I guess. More than that.
Since you got that computer in 1982, 35 years ago, that's when you started looking for community because you started spending your time online.
Well, no, there was no internet then. It was very, very primitive back in 1982. It was a COCO 64, 64K memory. That was a big deal. Now a single email is that big.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's a different world. I had to kind of raise my eyebrows when I heard you say that about completing relationships. It's like, how do I know when a relationship is ever complete, or even if I have another day to do that or another encounter to do that?
Right, right. Absolutely. As Homer said more than 2.5 millennia ago, any moment may be your last. You know, so that's why I think it's important to treat people in the here and the now as we wish to be treated ourselves, because we don't know. You just never know. Yeah, some people are showing signs that they're not going to last much longer. And then stunningly, they last another decade or two, and it blows our minds.
Oh, your desert anarchist had that story, right?
Absolutely, yes. You know, Edward Abbey thought he was going to die, and then he lasted quite a bit longer. And his medical doctor thought he was going to die years before he did. He was given the terminal diagnosis of a few weeks or a few months. His first response was classic Abbey. I guess I don't need to floss my teeth anymore.
Yeah.
And then he lived for several more years.
Yeah, my theater mentor Hazel was the same way. When I hosted her 90th birthday party, I knew it was her last. That was in May, and she hung out till October, much to the hospice nurse's surprise. The hospice nurse went on vacation at one point and told her goodbye, didn't expect to see her again.
But that's the thing. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing that can go wrong when you tell somebody goodbye. When you treat each moment as your last with somebody, and then you tell them you love them, what's wrong with that? And then you come back a year later, and that wasn't your last meeting with them. So you get to tell them goodbye, and you get to tell them you love them again. Is it so horrible? It's far worse to have it go the other way, to not say goodbye, to assume that you're going to have more time with this person, and then they disappear from our lives.
It's very painful, though. People tend to hide behind humor.
That's inconceivable. Somebody hiding behind humor? You must be kidding.
Tell them goodbye and tell them you love them. What are you trying to do, get rid of me?
I'm getting a lot less of that than I used to.
Well, there you go, because I guess you warn people up front, right?
Right, right. Hi, nice to meet you. I'm surprised we're not dead yet. It could happen within the next 3 minutes.
I know. I love that. I've taken to doing the same thing, you know? I mean, somebody asks me if I'll participate in thus and such an activity in February. I say, I don't think I'm going to be alive in February.
It's funny because I'll agree to do anything as long as it's more than 2 weeks away, because I can't imagine I'll be here then.
I somehow have a hard time making plans for anything beyond this week.
Well, I don't really plan for it. I just tell people, yeah, sure, I'll do an interview with you next month. Just send me an email message next month. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way I'm going
to
be able
to. Well, I'm going to thank you again then for putting this together on short notice rather than giving me a flippant yes.
Well, your work is important. And I have first world internet access for a few days. So we got lucky this time.
I'm really grateful for your presence, and I'm grateful for your support for my little show. I was hoping to have it up by this weekend, but I'm realizing I've got a lot more work to do.
Well, on the topic of being with people here and now, I really should go spend time with the people I'm with.
That sounds like a plan. I appreciate your taking the time to meet with me today. And
thank you very much for your work, Susan.
I'll look forward with a combination of eagerness and trepidation to the reactions in the world.
Course.
Would you like to tell our listeners how they can learn more about your work and become more involved in this ongoing conversation?
If you happen to find yourself at GuyMcPherson.com, you will discover that there is a workshop called Only Love Remains, for which we are accepting participants. Check it out. If you're interested, you've heard about it.
GuyMcPherson.com also has information about upcoming tours and instructions about how you too can become an organizer and bring Guy's presentation to your local community. You will also find links to his appearances as well as occasional essays. Finally, he and a top-flight team of administrators are very responsive to the virtual community that has gathered at the Facebook group Nature Bats Last. Okay. Take good care.
Thank you, Susan.
We'll talk
to
you.
Be well.
You do the same.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks also to Benjamin the Donkey for inspiration and support, for his help with hosting the show, and for his somewhat irreverent but always enlightened commentary, and to Zimt for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.